The Honorable, the Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Justice Kavanaugh has the opinion of the court this morning in case 23-235, Food and Drug Administration versus the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine.
Under federal law, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, an agency within the executive branch, ensures that drugs on the market are safe and effective. In 2000, FDA approved a new drug application for mifepristone, an abortion drug used to terminate pregnancies. FDA approved mifepristone for use up to 7 weeks of pregnancy. Only doctors could prescribe it, and patients were required to appear for 3 in-person visits with the doctor. In 2016, FDA relaxed some of those requirements. It deemed mifepristone safe to terminate pregnancies up to 10 weeks rather than 7 weeks. FDA allowed nurse practitioners to also prescribe the drug, and FDA reduced the number of required in-person visits from 3 to 1. In 2021, FDA further relaxed the requirements. Relying on experience gained during the pandemic, FDA announced that it would no longer enforce the initial in-person visit requirement. The 2016 and 2021 changes made it easier for doctors to prescribe and pregnant women to obtain mifepristone. Because mifepristone is used to terminate pregnancies, FDA's approval and regulation have generated substantial controversy from the start. This particular case began in 2022. 4 pro-life medical associations, as well as several individual doctors, sued FDA in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Texas, and the case eventually made its way to this court. As relevant here, the plaintiffs challenge FDA's 2016 and 2021 actions relaxing regulation of mifepristone. Importantly, the pro-life doctors and medical associations do not themselves prescribe or use mifepristone, and FDA is not requiring them to do or refrain from doing anything. Rather, the plaintiffs want FDA to make mifepristone more difficult for other doctors to prescribe and for pregnant women to obtain. The threshold question is whether the plaintiffs have standing to bring such a suit in federal court under Article 3 of the Constitution. Article 3 limits the role of the federal judiciary in our system of separated powers. As this court explained to President George Washington in 1793 in rejecting his request for a legal opinion, federal courts do not issue advisory opinions about the law, even when requested by the president. Instead, Article 3 limits federal courts to resolving cases where a plaintiff suffered an injury in fact that likely was caused by the defendant and that likely would be redressed by the requested judicial relief. Therefore, an Article 3 court is not a legislative assembly, a town square, or a faculty lounge. Article 3 does not contemplate a system where 330 million citizens can come to federal court whenever they believe the government is acting contrary to the Constitution or other federal law. By limiting who can sue, the standing requirement of Article 3 implements the framers' concept of the proper and properly limited role of the courts in a democratic society. The standing requirement means that the federal courts decide some contested legal questions later rather than sooner, and the standing requirement means that the federal courts may never need to decide some contested legal questions at all. As this court has said before, our system of government leaves many crucial decisions to the political processes, where democratic debate can occur and a wide variety of interests and views can be weighed. Here, the plaintiffs say that they are pro-life, oppose elective abortion, and have sincere objections to mifepristone being prescribed and used by others. When, as here, a plaintiff challenges the government's unlawful lack of regulation of someone else, it can be difficult for the plaintiff to establish standing. That is because unregulated parties may have more difficulty showing that the government's lack of regulation of some third party caused downstream injury to the plaintiffs. To thread the causation needle in those circumstances, the plaintiff must show that the third parties will likely react to the regulation in predictable ways that in turn will likely injure the plaintiffs. So to try to establish their standing here, the plaintiffs advanced three causation theories to connect FDA's actions to the plaintiffs' alleged injuries in fact. First, the doctors contend that FDA's 2016 and 2021 actions will cause more pregnant women to suffer complications from mifepristone, and those women, in turn, will need more emergency abortions by doctors. The plaintiff doctors say that they, therefore, may be required, against their consciences, to render emergency treatment completing the abortions or providing other abortion-related treatment. So the theory is that FDA's relaxed regulation of mifepristone will eventually cause these doctors to violate their consciences if they have to provide treatment to patients who suffer complications. But that argument is not correct because federal conscience laws fully protect doctors from being required to perform abortions or to provide other treatment that violates their consciences. In other words, under federal conscience laws, no doctors can be forced against their consciences to perform or assist in abortions. Those federal conscience laws and conscience protections therefore break any chain of causation between FDA's relaxed regulation of mifepristone and any asserted downstream injuries to the doctors here. So the plaintiff's first standing argument fails. Second, the doctors cite various monetary and related injuries that they allegedly will suffer as a result of FDA's actions. In particular, diverting resources and time from other patients to deal with patients with mifepristone complications, increasing risk of liability suits from treating those patients, and potentially increasing insurance costs. But the law has never permitted doctors to challenge the government's loosening of general public safety requirements simply because more individuals might then show up at emergency rooms or in doctors' offices with follow-on injuries. Stated otherwise, there is no Article III doctrine of doctor standing that allows doctors to challenge general government safety regulations, nor will this court now create such a novel standing doctrine out of whole cloth. The chain of causation is simply too attenuated. Allowing doctors or other healthcare providers to challenge general safety regulations as unlawfully lax would be an unprecedented and limitless approach and would allow doctors to sue in federal court to challenge almost any policy affecting public health. We decline to start the federal judiciary down that uncharted path. Third, the medical association plaintiffs say that they have standing because they incur costs in advocating against FDA's actions. But an organization that has not suffered a concrete injury caused by a defendant's action cannot spend its way into standing simply by spending money to advocate against the defendant's action. Finally, it has been suggested that the plaintiffs here must have standing because otherwise it may be that no one would have standing to challenge FDA's 2016 and 2021 actions. But even if no one would have standing, this court has long rejected that kind of, if not us, who, argument as a basis for standing. The argument that if these plaintiffs lack standing to sue, no one would have standing is not a reason to find standing. Rather, some issues may be left to the political and democratic processes. We recognize that these plaintiffs have sincere legal, moral, ideological, and policy objections to elective abortion and to FDA's relaxed regulation of mifepristone. but under Article 3 of the Constitution, those kinds of objections alone do not establish a case or controversy in federal court. Here, the plaintiffs have failed to demonstrate that FDA's relaxed regulatory requirements likely would cause them to suffer an injury in fact. For that reason, the federal courts are the wrong forum for addressing the plaintiffs' concerns about FDA's actions. The plaintiffs may present their concerns and objections to the President and FDA in the regulatory process, or to Congress and the President in the legislative process. And they may also express their views about abortion and mifepristone to fellow citizens, including in the political and electoral processes. This court has said before, no principle is more fundamental to the judiciary's proper role in our system of government than the constitutional limitation of federal court jurisdiction to actual cases or controversies. So it is here. We reverse the contrary judgment of the Court of Appeals. The opinion of the court is unanimous. Justice Thomas has filed a concurring opinion.
Justice Thomas has the opinion of the court this morning in two cases.
The first case I have is Vidal versus Elster, number 22704. This case comes to us on a writ of certiorari to the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. The Lanham Act governs the registration of trademarks. It contains a provision called the Names Clause that bars the registration of a trademark that contains a name identifying a particular living individual, except by that individual's written consent. In this case, Steve Elster sought to register a trademark containing the phrase "Trump too small" for use on T-shirts, on shirts and hats. The Patent and Trademark Office refused registration under the Names Clause. The Court of Appeals reversed, holding that the Names Clause violates the First Amendment protection of free speech. In an opinion filed with the clerk today, we reverse. When enforcing the First Amendment, our precedents have asked whether a regulation restricts speech based on its content or viewpoint. The Names Clause is content-based because it turns on the content of the proposed trademark, that is, whether it contains a person's name. But the Names Clause does not discriminate based on viewpoint. We thus confront for the first time the constitutionality of the content-based but viewpoint-neutral trademark restriction. Although heightened scrutiny would ordinarily apply to a content-based speech restriction, we conclude that it does not apply here. Since the founding, trademark protection has required drawing content-based distinctions, yet trademark rights have always coexisted comfortably with the First Amendment. Accordingly, we need not apply heightened scrutiny to a solely content-based trademark restriction. We do not delineate an exhaustive framework for which a content-based trademark restriction passes muster under the First Amendment. But in evaluating such a restriction, we can consider the history and tradition of the trademark restriction. The Names Clause has deep roots in our legal tradition. The common law restricted the trademarking of names, reflecting the notion that a person has ownership over his own name. This common law understanding carried over into federal statutory law. The Lanham Act's Name Clause reflects the common law's careful treatment of trademarking names. This history and tradition is sufficient to conclude that the Names Clause is compatible with the First Amendment. For these reasons and others set forth in our opinion, we reverse the judgment of the Federal Circuit. Justice Kavanaugh has filed an opinion concurring in part in which the Chief Justice joins. Justice Barrett has filed an opinion concurring in part in which Justice Kagan joins in full, and Justices Sotomayor and Jackson join in part. Justice Sotomayor has filed an opinion concurring in the judgment in which Justices Kagan and Jackson join. I'm quite a coalition builder. Starbucks Corporation, my second case is Starbucks Corporation versus McKinney, number 23367. This case comes to us on a writ of certiorari to the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. The National Labor Relations Board can bring in-house enforcement proceedings against employers and labor unions for engaging in unfair labor practices. Section 10J of the National Labor Relations Act authorizes the board to seek a preliminary injunction from a federal court while these administrative proceedings take place. This case requires us to determine what standard governs the board's request for a preliminary injunction under Section 10J. To assess whether the board was entitled to a preliminary injunction under Section 10J, the District Court and the Sixth Circuit applied a two-part test that asked whether there is reasonable cause to believe that unfair labor practices have occurred and whether injunctive relief is just and proper. Applying that test, the courts concluded that an injunction was warranted. In an opinion filed with the clerk today, we vacate and remand. When Congress empowers courts to grant equitable relief, there is a strong presumption that courts will exercise that authority in a manner consistent with traditional principles of equity. The traditional criteria for preliminary injunction requires the plaintiff to make a clear showing that he is likely to succeed on the merits, that he is likely to suffer irreparable harm in the absence of preliminary relief, that the balance of the equities tips in his favor, and that an injunction is in the public interest. Nothing in Section 10J displaces the presumption that these traditional principles govern. The board insists that the standard applied below is merely a context-sensitive application of the traditional criteria. We disagree. The standard applied by the courts below substantively lowered the bar for the board to obtain a preliminary injunction. For these reasons and others set forth in our opinion, we vacate the judgment of the Sixth Circuit and remand for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. Justice Jackson has filed an opinion concurring in part, concurring in the judgment, and dissenting in part.
Mr. Clerk, the court will entertain motions for admission to the bar of the court.
Margaret Roberts.
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Dawn Latosha Oliver of the state of Alabama, of the bar of the state of Alabama. I am satisfied that she has the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted. Ms. Oliver will be admitted.
Michelle Callen.
Ms. Callen.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Christopher Sean Land of the Bar of the State of Florida. I am satisfied that he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and Mr. Land will be admitted.
Terrence Griffin.
Mr. Griffin.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move for the admission of Aaron Nicholas Orcutt of the Bar of the State of New York. I am satisfied he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted. Mr. Orcutt will be admitted.
David Vermont.
Mr. Vermont.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Angela Stanton Doherty of the Bar of the Commonwealth of Virginia. I'm satisfied she possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted. Ms. Doherty will be admitted.
Stephen Vasbikian.
Ms. Vasbikian. Mr. Vasbikian.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of my son, Stephen Sahag Vasbikian, of the Bar of the State of New Jersey, and my daughter-in-law, Nairi Vasbikian, of the Bar of the State of New York.
Your motion is granted, and your son and your daughter-in-law will be admitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Michael Spears.
Mr. Spears?
Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, I move the admission of Gedney Main Howe IV and Michael Andrew Monastra of the Bar of the State of South Carolina. I am satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
Thank you.
Suzanne Wilson.
Ms. Wilson?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Emily Marie Lanza of the Bar of the State of Maryland, Joanna Ruth Blatchley and Andrew Thomas Foglia of the Bar of the State of New York, Benjamin Kagan Brady and Jalise Elizabeth Mangum of the Bar of the Commonwealth of Virginia. I am satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from the United States Department of Justice presented by Brian Fletcher.
Mr. Fletcher?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys. From the District of Columbia, Grant Lerner Tannenbaum and Carlos Felipe Uriarte. From Illinois, Stephen Hoover Hazel. From Maryland, Eliza Hahn Simon. From New York, Margot Griswold Benedict, Christopher Michael DeBono, Greta Gao, Stephen Andrew Myers, and Nathan Michael Swinton. And from Washington, Kevin Joseph Kennedy. I am satisfied that each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from Harvard Law School presented by Ariane DeGovaya.
Ms. DeGovaya?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys. California, Linda Ann Bagleyson, Blair Bernholtz Burke, Alan Waverly Hubsch Jr., Darcy August Paul, John Paul Ziakis, Connecticut, Robert Howard Hall, District of Columbia, James Michael Auslander, Kevin Claiborne Davis, Jessica Ray Herrera Flanagan, Jonathan Lazar Holbrook, Yolanda Claudette Griffin Lara, Daniel Draper Lynch, George Charles Neerlich III, Lindsay Nicole Simmons, Florida, Richard Marshall Zellman, Georgia, Rodney Joseph Gansky, Massachusetts, Sharon Kathleen Hoag, Mark Benjamin Sandberg, Maryland, Samantha Adams Miller, Harry Paul Rudo, New York, Frederick Jiacheng Ding, James Milton Hosking, Andrew David Kleber, Dick Borsire Maragia, Seton Hartnett O'Brien, Michael David Saarinen, Imani Carla Tisdale, Doris Rose Varlis, Ohio, Monica Levine Lax, Oregon, Stephanie E. L. McCleary, Virginia, Jeffrey Aaron Hall. I am satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from the Philadelphia Bar Association presented by Jennifer Coatsworth.
Ms. Coatsworth?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move for the admission of the following attorneys from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Shalisa Jennifer Brunson, Robert Anthony Burke, Emily Claire Byrne, Paul Michael Carrion Jr., Jacqueline Marie DiColo, Courtney Elizabeth Dalloway, Stacy Therese Forchetti, Jordan Jair Friedman, Rhonda May Fulginity, Sydney Lynn Grohl, Amanda Rosalie Hamar, Jolly Jeremiah Hatchett, Thomas Donald Kenny, Taisha Colleen Miley. Elizabeth Ann Perez. Sean Lawrence Phelan. Jessica Elizabeth Rodriguez. William Michael Smith. Allison Lindsay Storr. Damian Nicholas Tancredi. I am satisfied that each of these attorneys possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted. If all the applicants will stand, the clerk will administer the oath. But before he does so, I would like to extend to each of you a warm welcome as a member of the Bar of the Court and an officer of the Court.
Raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear that as an attorney and as a counselor of this court, you will conduct yourself uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States, so help you God?
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.